From Beijing to Berlin, from Singapore to South Carolina, from Cape Town to Canada, the world turns on business and commerce. And where there is such industry, disagreements are bound to happen. Sometimes these disagreements are resolved. For the rest of the time, they end up in the capable hands of professionals around the world. The dynamic and interesting stories of these individuals is what you will hear on this show, Tales of the Tribunal. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell. I am your host, Chris Campbell, and I am very glad to be back here with you, dear listener, with all of you out there in podcast. I was going to say radio land, but podcast land, listening. I have, as I mentioned last week, returned from the United States across the mighty sea back to the great continent of Europe. I took a short detour to Europe, to Portugal before coming back to Florence, Italy. So if you hear some hustle and bustle outside, you know, some street vendors, perhaps some tourists, some other sights and sounds from Florence, that is what's going on in the background. Nevertheless, it is good to be back here with you to talk about international dispute resolution. So before we get into talking about today's show, I'd like to mention something to you, something new to the world of international dispute resolution, something that we talked about briefly in the intro to last week's show. And that is that there is still time to sign up for a unique opportunity and program going on in Vienna, Austria, hosted by the International Disputes Professional Academy, aka the Negotiation Academy for short, focusing on negotiation, mediation, and dispute management skills. The training opportunity will go on from July 11th through July 16th and give you some high-level training on using dispute management skills to enhance your career. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there, too. We'll post a link in the show notes in today's episode. I think it'll be a good time. Again, I plan to be there, and I hope to meet some of you folks, some of you listeners to the podcast. Anyway, moving on to today's guest. She was a partner at a prominent New York City law firm and is the current president of Arbitral Women. I'm speaking, of course, of none other than Miss Dana McGrath. Dana and I had an opportunity to meet up at, actually, the Wiesmut First in Vienna. We tried to sit down for an interview there, but as you can imagine, being the president of Arbitral Women and having a number of other activities going on in the city, it was difficult to find time for an interview. So I said, I'll come to New York. And while I was in the United States, I was able to make a short detour up into New York, and we were able to sit down for an interview. So this is the conversation that we had. It was a fascinating interview. Dana has done so much over her storied career, and I think that you will hear some great anecdotes and war stories and all everything in between. So in any case, that is the intro. I hope that you'll stick around for the show notes at the end of the show. And here's my interview with Dana McGrath. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal. I am your host, Chris Campbell. And with me today, I have a very special guest. I know I'm typically in Florence, Italy, but today I have come across the ocean to the great state of New York and the great city therein, and I'm interviewing none other than the president of Arbitral Women herself, Ms. Dana McGrath. Say hello to the show, Dana.
Hello. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Chris.
Fantastic. Now, Dana, as we've now established here on the past few weeks of the show, we like to be very relaxed here. We like to be very casual, and we're going to let you just do a brief introduction and explanation of who you are, where you're from, what do the people need to know about you?
Well, I have been in international arbitration now for about 20 years. Most of that time, I was a practicing lawyer with multinational firms and arbitration practices. So most recently, I was at Sidley as a partner in the arbitration practice based in New York. Prior to that, I was with Allen & Overy. Before that, O'Melveny & Myers, always in the arbitration group. And I've focused on commercial arbitration largely. I also done some treaty arbitration and some award enforcement litigation in aid of arbitration. So those are the sort of high level topics that I did as a practitioner. And then in January of 2019, I joined Bentham IMF, which is one of the most experienced third party funders. I joined the U.S. entity, Bentham IMF, which is the U.S. arm of IMF Bentham, or called IMF, in parts of the world, and that is headquartered in Australia. So I'm with a global funding company heading up their arbitration matters.
Truly an international experience. Oh, yeah, wow. Okay, so let's take a step back. Let's rewind for just a bit. Before you were doing all of this great, you know, world-changing stuff, where are you from? Like, where did you grow up? You know, where did you go to school?
I am born and raised in New York City.
Oh, okay. From the Big Apple.
Yes.
All right.
Went to Vermont for college, Middlebury College, then back to New York for law school at NYU.
Okay.
And I've basically been here for my career, but my career has taken me everywhere but here for my work.
Well, sure. You know, there and back again. Well, fair enough. And so you're with Bentham now. You've worked, did some law firm work before that. What drove that? Was that something you always knew that you wanted to do? Or was it something that you kind of built the plane as it was flying, so to speak? You know, when as you learned as you went along?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is some advice that I give to young people when they say, you know, how do I get involved in international arbitration or what should I do next? My experience has been that opportunities come to you at the time that you're ready for them. And Bentham is a perfect example. I was not looking to make a job change, a firm change, a change. I was happy practicing international arbitration and had been doing it for 20 years. Had been at different firms, but, you know, really loved my practice. And then I was approached by Bentham, and I was like, well, this is such a hot area. I should probably talk to them. And one thing led to another, and I really found the discussions, you know, intriguing, interesting. The work sounded, you know, rewarding and really varied. And it just decided that based on those discussions, I learned a lot more about the funding industry that I didn't know as much about from our first discussions, and decided that this was a great opportunity. And so I kind of surprised a lot of friends and family when I made this change, because everyone kind of expected me to be doing the same thing for another 10, 20 years. And I'm loving it. It's been a really good change.
Well, sure. And so let's dig into that a bit. One, what is the biggest difference that you've noticed or seen so far from going from law firm life to now being with a funder? And what does a typical day look like in the world of funding?
So no day is the same. That's okay. One thing that's a huge distinction from practicing at the law firm. It is very fast paced. I feel there's some aspects of what I believe in-house practice is, where you have like lots of matters and, you know, you're jumping from matter to matter to matter, meeting to meeting. And, you know, there's just a whole bunch of different things that are progressing at the same time. And you're working with a lot of different people. You're working with the clients, you're working with the outside counsel, you're working sometimes with the experts, you're working with a whole bunch of different constituents on any number of matters. Whereas when I was in practice, you know, I was very focused on the arbitrations that I was working on. And sometimes you feel kind of siloed. Sure. Because a case is getting ready for hearing and you really have to be all about that case for a certain period of time. I find in my new role that I'm just doing a really diverse group of projects any given day.
Right.
So I like that, because it's like each day you just don't know exactly what you're going to be doing, but you know you're going to be learning something new, talking to someone that you never spoke to before, and it's very exciting. I'm learning a lot about the practice of arbitration too, because it's a different vantage point from a funder's perspective.
Right. How about, do you miss acting as in the counsel role from the extent of the oral advocacy or, you know, being up in front of the decider, the neutral? You miss that?
Well, I've only been in it now for a few months. So
not yet.
That said, yeah, that can say not yet. But also, you know, there is a fair amount of advocacy in almost any job, I think, in the legal profession. So I think that's a question you could put to someone who went in-house at a corporation. But I bet in your job, there's a fair amount of oral advocacy for positions that you were trying to counsel the company to take. In my role as a funder, you know, I'm evaluating whether we should fund certain arbitration matters. And then if I think we should, you know, I have to advocate and convince, you know, a really sophisticated group of on a committee that this is a proper investment. So I'm doing a lot of oral advocacy in my current job. It's just not the same advocacy.
Sure. And would you say that that topic, the sometimes having to convince internal stakeholders on a given arbitration, is that the most difficult part? Or, you know, what sort of challenges do you think are kind of come with working for a funder?
I think each case has, you know, different challenges. I definitely think that the, when you present a case to your committee or whatever funders work differently, but there's always some sort of a process by which, you know, an investment is recommended and then has to be presented to a committee to decide. And that process is a challenging process because you're really trying to kick the tires, test the case, understand the strengths and weaknesses, you know, try to look at it objectively. You know, all cases have strengths and weaknesses, but are you really seeing them objectively? And anticipate things that maybe the law firm handling the case hasn't anticipated, because I was 20 years in counsel and I know what it is to look at a case through the lens of I am an advocate for the claimant or the respondent. And it's a different perspective. So now I'm sort of in a perspective of a neutral, which is kind of close to the role of an arbitrator, although I would say the job is very different. You know, I'm also an arbitrator.
Right.
I would not equate the roles, but the, you know, trying to have a neutral perspective on a dispute where you're hearing more about it from one side than another, or, you know, that is challenging. And it's also fun to actually identify issues that maybe the counsel themselves hadn't identified as, ooh, this is something that we should run down, or well, could you make this argument? And that's one thing that Bentham really prides itself on. The team collaborates with the lawyers and offers, you know, legal insights, because this is an area I've been practicing in 20 years. You know, I'm not trying the cases anymore. They're
right.
Not my cases. They're someone else's. But if I read the file and I see an issue, you know, I could raise that issue for them to look into. And I think that's appreciative. That's kind of part of what you get when you get funding.
Sure. And just shifting focus just a little bit. So going from stepping away from your role as a funder or in a funding organization, what is keeping you busy in the extracurricular sense outside of work, but maybe still industry related? Are you working on any projects or anything like that?
I am. I think we met in connection with one of my projects.
Factual. That
right,
is true.
Exactly.
Disclosure. We Dana and I actually met during the VSMOOT, which for those of you that have been listening since the beginning is where some of our early episodes took place. But during that same time frame, during the Arbitration Olympics. But
right. So the VSMOOT for me this year in 2019 was a combination of coaching a team competing in the VIS in Vienna, and also being in Vienna on behalf of Arbitral Women, of which I am president, because we were having our annual meeting, which is the annual sort of shareholders meeting, you know, where we sort of brief everyone on last year's events and where the organization's going forward. And so we had our annual meeting and an event, a career-oriented event that same day in the middle of the VSMOOT. And that's where I met you.
Yes, that's right. That is true. So I think that most of the folks listening will be familiar with Arbitral Women and know what you guys do. But would you, for the benefit of the listeners at home, would you describe what is Arbitral Women and what are you all about?
So Arbitral Women is an international nonprofit organization that promotes women and diversity in international dispute resolution. We have a broad membership from about 1,000 members from 40 different countries. Anyone in any form of dispute resolution who's a woman can be a member. We have a 25-year track history. We celebrated our 25th anniversary in 2018. And we have kind of three main things that we do. We try to offer mentoring for anyone who wants to enter this field or progress in this field. Mentoring is one of our main projects. We also are really trying to help increase the number of women in either arbitral tribunals or in the counsel position in cases. And we do that in a couple ways. One is that we're trying to give visibility to our members for any of their achievements. So if a member is appointed to a committee or head of a committee or some sort of professional achievement, we will promote that in our newsletter, in our news alerts, on social media. So, and this is a relatively new thing. It used to be sort of done quarterly in our newsletter. Now we're trying to do contemporaneous promotion of our members when they have an achievement, get it out there real time. So that when people say, we don't know who the women arbitrators are who are qualified to handle these cases, we can say, yes, you do, because look at all of the women that we have put news out about. So we try to promote our members on all of their, so when we promote on a specific achievement, congratulations for being appointed to the Council of X, we then also describe their CV, you know, their highlights of their credentials and skill set. So basically we're trying to get the members to come to us and say, I just had a really great achievement, would you cover it? But we find that many members are somewhat modest, and we've actually started going out to them when we see that they have an achievement. And we're like, congratulations on your appointment to X. And they're like, thank you. We'd like to cover it on Arbitral Women's website. Are you interested? Usually they say yes. And so then we promote them. But it's interesting that women don't always reach out and look for the promotion. And so we're trying to really encourage women to recognize that each achievement that they have is something that can be promoted. And every time their name is put out there, makes it more and more likely they're going to be recognized as a candidate to put on a tribunal.
Exactly. And that one of the last things that you just said is something that harkens to what friend of the show, Claudia Winkler, was talking about from the Negotiation Academy in terms of giving the green light to make sure that it's okay to be self-promotive or to really talk about your achievements. It's not bragging if it's true.
Right.
And I think that that's an important lesson for all professionals, but in particular women to highlight and recognize as they go through their careers.
I think it's something that women really need to help each other with, because I find myself falling into the same behavioral patterns as the women who are not promoting themselves. You know, when it comes to my own achievements, I'm the last person to say something. And then somebody else is like, but Dana, you just had a new job. You just had a new position. That's what we promote. I'm like, you're right. I'm so focused on promoting everybody else. I'm not focused on promoting mine. I don't have that many, so it doesn't take up too much space.
You just did it.
But I'm just saying that even if you believe that women should speak up for themselves and women should, you know, get comfortable promoting themselves, it's not always natural. And that's why we are trying to reach out and ring the bell. And it's working. Women are getting more and more comfortable reaching out to us now because we've reached out to them.
Well, sure. For the folks that want to get engaged with Arbitral Women, what's the best way to do that?
Go to our website and register as a member. A lot of law firms have corporate memberships, so if you're with a law firm, you should check with your department or whatever to see if your firm is a corporate member. And once you're a member, you put as much information as you want about yourself in our database. And then our database is available for anyone to search. Uh-huh. You don't have to be a member to search our database. So if you speak 6 languages, if you have all sorts of degrees, expertise in oil and gas, whatever it is that you have expertise in, put it on the website, because people come to our organization and say, we are looking for arbitrators that have X experience or speak whatever language. And you can search the database for different, you know, drop down language, skill set. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of different things you can search for. So the more you put of yourself on our database, the more likely you're going to be found.
Yeah, that's right. So one more question before we move on from Arbitral Women in particular. And it might be interesting to frame this way. Has there been any pushback or any resistance to what you guys are trying to do at Arbitral Women? Has there been anyone that said, you know, this is not an initiative that we need, you know, things are fine? or has it mostly been pretty supportive and receptive?
I would say that there's been overwhelming success and support for arbitral women, especially in the past few years. What we are asked more and more is, how can arbitral women broaden to do more for diverse groups in addition to women?
Sure. Intersectionality.
So, right.
Yeah.
So, and we did a fair amount of that when we had a conference in the end of November 2018. We had a full day diversity conference, and it was not only on women. And we try to focus on a sort of a broad cross-section of diversity issues. But that's what we're asked. People, nobody says arbitral women is not needed anymore because women have arrived. Nobody says that.
Right.
Everybody recognizes that there's still work to be done for women to reach equality. But they also see the organization as having a platform that could do more for diversity than just women. And that's what we're trying to respond to that.
Wow. Well, certainly busy indeed in both your work and in the extracurricular sense. Here's another question for you, Dana. As busy as you are, you know, running Arbitral Women, working in your role for a funder, living life, what have been some of the guiding influences or maybe role models or maybe even mentors that have been influential for you in developing in your career? Have you had some of those?
Yes, I think everybody in their career by the stage I am has had a few mentors. I would say that in my law firm practice, you know, I had one or two mentors that were really instrumental in teaching me how to be a good arbitration lawyer and how to analyze a case and choose sort of, you know, what are the key issues and what are the issues that are, you know, not so important to focus on. And really, you know, I learned early on that a huge part of being a successful arbitration lawyer is exercising good judgment, that's what the client really hires you for and needs. They assume you're smart and you're good at arbitration and all of the things you can do as an advocate, but your judgment is really critical to how their case will be run. And so I thought that was, you know, something that you can sort of know implicitly, but it was really emphasized with me early on, you know, the client's relying on our judgment call here. And that's what we bring, that they nobody else is going to make the same judgment call. What's our view on X? And so that was very helpful. And it encourages you at an early stage in your career to articulate, what's your view on this? And I had a couple cases early in my career where it was a big group on the team. I was not by any way the senior person on the team. It was a litigation, and people were sort of like, well, maybe we can move for summary judgment. It was early in the case, and I said, why don't we move to dismiss on these three claims now? And everyone was like, what? Now? Move to dismiss?
They looked at you like you were crazy.
Pay for that. Like, that's just... And like a week later, people kind of came around. They're like, wait, maybe we should do that. Maybe it's not too early. You know, maybe if we, and we did, and long story short, we moved on 7 claims and we got 6 of the 7 claims dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage. And that hugely changed the nature of the case, which obviously settled at some point.
Sure.
You know, the case is that much narrowed. But often people just think, oh, the motion to dismiss is too early a stage to really go all in, because it was a kind of case that, like, whenever you did it, you were going to go all in. And that's that was an example of something I probably would not have felt I should raise as a second year associate. Let's do this. If
right.
The messaging from my mentors wasn't about everyone's independent judgment in this room on this team matters. We work as a team. Obviously, people respect authority, and you know, there's someone who runs a case, but everyone's opinion matters and has something constructive to add. So I would say that people who are junior in their roles at their law firm or company or whatever should not be brazen, but should think about if they have a view or a suggestion on how the case strategy should be developed. You know, they could say it and people could say, thanks, great idea, we're not going to go that way. But if they never say it, they don't develop the experience of taking a position early on. And who knows, you know, they might not take that position until they're like a fifth or sixth year, and getting a negative reaction to your proposal as a fifth or sixth year feels a little bit more scary when you're like getting close to years where decisions are made. Why not try it out when you're younger?
That's right. That's right. So a little bit lighter, a little bit lighter of a topic. How about this? And this is a problem, or this is an issue that comes up, I think, a lot with folks in the practice of law. When we get busy, when you have lots of assignments, sometimes folks will neglect their taking care of themselves in both the physical and the mental sense. How do you maintain that balance? How do you make sure that you're taking care of your body, but also taking care of having a clear mind so that you can work effectively?
Well, I think everybody does it in their own way. So for me, I live in New York City, but I really like to get out of the city on the weekends. That really helps me clear my head. So I live in Brooklyn, but pretty far out in Brooklyn. So I go to Prospect Park and the Botanic Gardens and just sort of feel like I'm away from the frenetic energy of New York City. And, you know, those are things that I like to do. I'm not a morning person, so I can't say I'm up at 5:30 in the morning running around Prospect Park. I know someone who does that, and I think of them at around 6 when I wake up.
But that's still pretty early.
Yeah, well, that's the kids thing. That's
right. Oh, right, right. The theme, right.
My favorite music starts at 6.
Right. Right. Okay, that's fair enough. What non-law or business or industry-related things are you looking forward to in 2019? For the rest of the year, I guess we got about half the year left.
So I'm looking forward to summer vacation.
Oh, okay.
I like to go to Fire Island, which is a barrier island off of Long Island, which is about as remote as you can get in the New York City vicinity, where there are no cars and it's a really, you know, a pretty limited barrier island with a beautiful beach. And I'm looking forward to some family events coming up. My son's high school graduation. He's off to college.
Congratulations.
And, yep. It's been a huge milestone year for us, going from having a college applicant to having a future college student.
Right.
And it'll be a nice summer because it's the summer that he's not worrying about getting into college, which many summers prior to that have been sort of overhanging our summer. So that's good. Looking forward to that.
Sure. I mean, that's a lot of good things to look forward to and out of the house, at least for a little bit.
Yes.
So we kind of touched on this at the beginning of the interview, Dana. If you were approached by a recent law school graduate or someone that's not quite in the field yet, and they're looking to get into international dispute resolution, have their big break, and they say, Dana, you know, I know that you're a big dog, a celebrity in international arbitration. How do I break in? What advice would you give them?
So I would advise anyone who's looking to get involved in arbitration at whatever level of seniority to get involved in the arbitration groups in their community. So for my community, you know, it's in New York. It's things like the New York City Bar and the New York State Bar. And, you know, the ABA has groups. The arbitral institutions have young groups for young people, but there are lots of different groups for the arbitral institutions because networking is really invaluable to understanding the field and getting an entree to a position in the field. I would also say that more often than not, I have seen people enter the field in a non-obvious way, sort of a non-linear path that ultimately lands them in arbitration in the way they want to be. And having coached the Brooklyn VIST team for more than 10 years, I have, you know, 10 years worth of students who have in varying degrees wanted to be in this field. Some got jobs at law firms that did this, and it was just straight out of law school, obvious that they were going to enter the arbitration practice or litigation practice at X firm. Others didn't. The VIST Moot Network was hugely helpful for them. Some of them took jobs doing transactional work. They didn't think they wanted to do transactional work. They wanted to do what was like this stuff, that international arbitration stuff. But having had a couple years in the transactional world, when you then transition to the arbitration world, you have an insight into how the transactions are negotiated and, you know, what those contract documents mean. And you bring a different kind of mindset and value to the team in arbitration. So I think that whatever opportunities you're presented with, you should really be open-minded about them and never feel that by taking an opportunity, you're foreclosed from a path towards arbitration later. Because I've seen people do a lot of different things and then end up in the arbitration world within 3 years.
Sure, sure. No, I think that's all good advice. I think it's those are some good ways to find the gaps in the system where you can fit. So, and we're coming to the end of the interview. It's about 5 p.m. on a Friday. For some reason, all matters that you have on your desk are, you know, suspended. You don't have anything specifically you've got to take care of over the weekend. What does your ideal weekend look like? You can do whatever you'd like for the next couple of days.
I really like to just decompress in Brooklyn. I live in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, and just go to the park with my family, have some friends over for dinner, you know, just really enjoy the nature and being outside and being with friends.
Sure. Yeah. Sounds like a great weekend. All right, Dana. So final question of the show. Any shout outs, anything you want to say to the folks at home?
Well, I'd like to give a shout out for Mike McElrath, who is a great champion of diversity. He and I have collaborated on a number of things, including the CPR Diversity Award that was recently given to Merez Philippe and Lucy Greenwood. And I thought that was a fabulous, fabulous thing that Mike did. He gathered the whole, not the whole, but a huge part of the international arbitration community to support their nomination for the diversity work that they've done over 20, 30 years. And it was a really special moment when I saw that Merez was in person to receive the award. And I've told Mike all of this, but it was just really inspiring that Mike was behind that. And I know that he's behind other things like that. So shout out for Mike.
Shout out to Mike, and I'll make sure I'm playing this when I'm sitting across the hall from you, so you can, so I can see your reaction. Anyway, well, Dana, do you want to sign us off?
Okay, I'm Dana McGrath, and there is no disputing it. You are listening to Tales of the Tribunal.
So that was my interview with Dana McGrath. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I have had the pleasure of meeting Dana several times in person now, and every time, I must say, Dana is very welcoming, very warm, and has been a wealth of information, not just to international dispute resolution, but also just on business development, growing your brand, getting your name out there international, in the international law or business world. And so if you have a chance, you should absolutely talk to Dana. She's a fantastic person. If you see her at a conference or something similar, she's been nothing but helpful in those regards. So, moving on just a bit from there, let's talk about what's coming up. Right now, as I mentioned at the show's outset, I'm sitting here in Florence, Italy, probably going to go have an espresso or something else to start the day. That's really just a joke. I don't actually drink coffee. But from today, I will be in Florence another week or so, and then I'm headed to London to hang out at a couple of events in London and do some work there, and then I will be headed to Zurich for an event that we've mentioned previously on the show, the IAJA 11th Annual Arbitration Conference. Now, That conference is going to be a great time. It's going to be from June 27th to June 30th in Zurich. And I will be sitting on a panel called Has Arbitration Become Too Expensive? I'll be taking the in-house counsel perspective, but I'll be sitting with two other fine professionals, Alina Liovanu of the ICC in Paris, and Ewelina Wetris of K&L Gates in Poland. So the three of us will come together to discuss that conversation and that topic of has arbitration become too expensive? I'd be curious to know what some of the listeners feel about this question. Surely there have been some frustrations with cost and topics related there too. Perhaps you need a financer or a funder to help you out with those types of things if you are a user. But yes, let me know about it either in the comments and if you see me out at a conference or see me somewhere else. I'd love to know your thoughts on that. Secondly, another event that we've mentioned previously on the show, and it's a great opportunity because it is free, as in no cost to folks that want to attend, is the ABA webinar on July 11th on the topic of the magic words, language translation and litigation and arbitration. It is a CLE that is hosted in concert between the International Litigation Committee and the International Arbitration Committee of the Section of International Law in the American Bar Association. Try saying that three times fast. In any case, what matters is that this CLE, not in addition to being CLE credit, which we, as at least for American lawyers, have to do on a regular basis, but also is just a fine opportunity to get some in-depth practical knowledge on translation and language issues that come up during litigation or arbitration proceedings. That can include things like simultaneous translation, things like translating accurately from an expert witness, and all sorts of topics in between. So some of the speakers that you'll be hearing in that panel would be Cheyenne Bao from Hong Kong, who's an independent arbitrator there, Mr. Duarte Henriquez from BCH in Lisbon, Nicholas Pikowitz from Graf & Pikowitz in Austria, and Mr. John Branson of Womble Bond & Dickinson in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I will be moderating that panel. So we hope to see you on that call. If you'd like to register for that, I'll include a link in the show notes, but you can find it also on the ABA website under the Section of International Law. It should be on both the International Litigation and Arbitration Committees. So beyond that, if you've enjoyed the show or you have anything to say about the show, I hope that you would leave a review on Apple Podcasts and under iTunes. Tales of the Tribunal is the name of the show. Or Podbean. We're apparently on Spotify now. I wasn't aware we're on Spotify until someone specifically told me last week that they enjoyed listening on Spotify. It still shows me as pending. So apparently we're on Spotify now. We're also on the Google Play Store. And, of course, we can be reached via email at talesofthetribunal@gmail.com. I've enjoyed reading a few reviews and comments via email already, so feel free to drop me a line there. Otherwise, I will share this, and I hope that you enjoy the show and that you'll tune in again next week. Please recommend the show to colleagues and friends, and without further ado, there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal.